clock, get ready. We're going to open the Senate Interim Committee on Education. Today is January 8th. That's not right. 14th. I was reading instead of thinking. Okay, January 14th. We are going to start with some open informational meetings on Committee LC presentations, and they should be short, just a short explanation about it, and then we have to take a vote to send them. And as I've said before, and I'll say it again, introducing bills from a committee does not mean you are for or against them. It just gets them in the process so that they can move forward. So with that, we have three invited speakers on LC 24, Vern Sabo and Phil Donovan. If you want to come up forward, that would be great. And we are into an informational meeting.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Dr. Vern Sabo representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. This is a straightforward bill concept. It simply inserts chiropractic and naturopathic physicians into statute as one of the healthcare professionals that can assess a athlete suspected of having a concussion and return that athlete to play immediately as if they're on the sidelines. And then also for those athletes who have suffered a known concussion can, in fact, return them to play as the signs and symptoms dissipate and they can go back to the graduated program to reinsert themselves into play. The only other issue is the reality that many of my colleagues go on beyond the four-year degree program and become board certified in sports injury, and many of them are on the college level, university, the U.S. Olympic medical team, and in the professional sports as well, including the 49ers who just hired Chip Kelly. That completes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. First off, we are in support of introduction of LC 24. As increasingly more patients turn to naturopathic physicians for care in a primary care setting, we've seen an increase in the number of calls to our office saying, hey, why can't we sign this form off? So, and when you have that, the end result is the patient has to schedule another appointment. They duplicate visits. You've got more cost. You got delay. So with the primary care training that naturopathic physicians have, we would appreciate the change in the statute. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. So any questions of these people? This is to fix a bill we had last session when we changed it so that the private schools and the public schools were being treated the same with respect to concussion injuries. If you remember, it used to be that a private school, they had to wait till the next game. They didn't have any option to put somebody back in, even if they had a doctor on the sideline. Public schools did because of the way the bill was written. This, even the playing field, as we say. And then when we did that, we took out a couple of the people who in the past had been part of this inadvertently, and that's kind of the issue to put back together. So.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I was happy that we passed this bill when we passed it. It seemed like a good bill. And you fast forward to September, the day before school started, my daughter received her third concussion. And so it was one of the first experiences that the district had under the new rule, and she had to go to the pediatrician and have this very stepped out process. My daughter didn't love it because it was longer before she returned to play, but the pediatrician indicated how much she appreciated the bill, and she said she actually had a line of coaches that after kind of fall football prep, because she wasn't letting she wasn't approving the kids to go back out on the football team yet because their brains weren't ready to go. So I think that really the impact of yep. this bill has been positive. And I'm pleased for those that brought it.
I think it's really good. So I appreciate that. And any other questions? Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will keep the informational ones open, and we'll get because we'll do them all at the same time. So the next group up is LC 125, Karen Ikus. Karen?
LC 125 is a committee bill that relates to the funding of public charter schools.
On the group of one.
That's good.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Karin Hikas, and I am with Kairos PDX and a number of other charter schools. I've been a public educator forever and working with charter schools for the last 10 years or so. I am here to talk about LC 125, which is essentially a rewrite of Senate Bill 819, which Senator Roblin sponsored last session and passed out of this committee 6-1. And what it would do is address what I would characterize as a longstanding problem, which is the inequitable funding of kids in public charter schools. Here are some of our challenges. Number one, we have an inadequate funding level for K-12 kids, period, in this state. I don't know any stakeholders that disagree with that. Number two, we have an inequitable allocation of those limited resources to one sector of our public school system, which is public charter schools. Another challenge is that all the stakeholders have not yet agreed on the problem. So the data that we do have is not as helpful as it could be. We need to have consensus on the problem and collect and analyze valid data, data we will all consider valid, which I hope exists somewhere, to help us determine how charter schools should be funded within this context of scarce resources. So what LC 125 proposes and what 819 proposed is a more equitable funding model for our charter schools. This does not propose mathematical equity between districts and charters on a per pupil basis. That has never been our ask. It's never been our position. I'm a former English teacher, so math is, you know, not my best subject. School funding is really convoluted for me. Maybe you all have it all figured out, but I haven't met a lot of folks who have it all figured out. So let's just say, for the sake of conversation, each kid is allocated $100 per year for their education. Approximately, depending on the district you're in, about $60 of that is the ADM weight. Maybe $10 of that is local money and federal money, again, depending on your district. Maybe $10 of that is SPED money. Maybe $20 of that is facilities. What LC 125 asks for is 95% of the ADM weight and the federal and local, excluding facilities and SPED. So we're really asking for 95% of $70. 95% of 70%, which is $66.50. Just to clarify on the math, the best that I am able. Senator Roblin has convened an interim work group on this issue. We have met twice, and we will continue to meet to try to reach consensus on defining the problem and defining the solution. Represented on this work group to date, legislators, Senator Roblin, Representative Buckley, Representative Doherty, Representative Huffman, Frederick, and Smith-Warner. We've had lobbyists representing the Oregon Department of Education, Oregon Education Association, Oregon School Boards Association, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, Oregon School Employees Association, Portland Public Schools, Beaverton School District, and we've had charter school leaders, myself, Kids Unlimited in Medford, and Trillium Charter School in Portland. We do have a mediator who we met with yesterday who I believe will work for all of us, from what I'm hearing. The membership and the scope and the process of this work group are still being crafted. But we will continue to meet, and I and the charter schools that I work with look forward to continuing to work with all the stakeholders. And you may see some amendments coming your way in February.
So the bill as written probably is not what you're going to actually see. We have come to a little bit of an agreement on a few things with which we believe everybody can agree to, and we are getting drafted amendments for that, but the bill is the tool that we're going to be using for that. And we anticipate that in 2017, if this whole mediated process works out, we'll have another bill for you. So that's kind of where that's at. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And our last LC is relating to, well, I'll let you do that, and that has Sarah Gelser. You want to do it from up here?
Yep. Is that okay?
Yep.
So you may recall we had some lively conversation last year about something that we referred to as fifth-year programs, and the way that we left it at the end of the session was that there would be a work group that was tasked with coming back with a proposal that would allow equity statewide, so that it wasn't that some people could take advantage of this and others wouldn't, that was sustainable, wouldn't break the state school fund bank, and that really made sure that districts weren't making money off of these proposals and that focused on kids that needed it the most. So I think we have a proposal that does that. I will acknowledge not everybody will love everything about it. If you absolutely believe that state school fund dollars should never be used for a kid who's been in high school for 4 years to go to community college, this still does that. So I want to acknowledge that right up front. But it narrows it very, very significantly. The first thing it does is it creates, we're naming what this is called. We're naming the population of kids. So a student who has completed 4 years of high school and has satisfied the requirements of a standard high school diploma is called in the bill a postgraduate scholar. And what the bill is about is when can a school district claim state school fund for a postgraduate scholar. So there's two different triggers that have to be met. The first is a set for students, and the second is a set for districts. For a student to be eligible to participate, they have to complete their federal application for financial aid, and they have to apply for the Oregon Promise. If they're eligible for the Oregon Promise, they must enroll in the Oregon, well, they don't have to enroll in the Oregon Promise, but they can't enroll as a postgraduate scholar. For a school district to be able to claim one of these students, so now you're really looking at a universe of students who have below a 2.5 grade point average, the school district has to meet a variety of criteria. The first is they have to have written policies about how their program relates to their goals with improving their high school graduation rate. How does this program get more kids across the stage at graduation? Two, what are the standards for courses that are taken, GPA and attendance, and participation in at least bi-monthly face-to-face meetings with an employee of the school district. And they must have enough staff dedicated that they can do these one-on-one visits on the school district campus with these students twice a month. And then the last is that the district has to ensure that the majority of students earning college credit on a community college campus in their district are not postgraduate scholars. So that means before they can offer this program to a student who satisfied those requirements, they have to be offering opportunities to kids in grades 9 through 12, kids that have GEDs or modified diplomas or extended diplomas, or the postgraduate scholars have to be in a special category, like they were foster children, they are homeless, just things that put them at an enhanced risk. Finally, the funding for this goes down. Right now, districts are claiming a full weight for each of these kids. There would be no enhancement, so no poverty funding, no ELL funding, no special ed funding for these students. In the first school year, it would be a 1.0, so this upcoming school year. Then it would drop to 0.85, and then it would drop to 0.75. And then in 2018, the Department of Education will come back and be able to tell us how much did we actually spend on this set of students and recommend what, if any, state school weight should be devoted to this, or if there is a better mechanism to ensure that students that aren't picked up by the Oregon Promise can move forward and access a post-secondary education program. And the superintendents we had a very large work group. We met in Albany. People drove from as far away as Redmond and Klamath Falls. They are giving up a lot in this. For instance, SIO, they have a requirement in their fifth-year program that everybody has to have, I believe it's at least a 3.0. So all of those students will immediately come out of the program this year because they'll all go into the Oregon Promise. So in the first year, even though we are describing this program, less money than was spent this year will be spent. And then the reimbursement will decline. And anybody can jump in if they want, but the cost controls are the reduced share of the ADM and the requirement that the majority of students cannot be postgraduate scholars. So you have to have two kids earning college credits on a college campus. So it's not just your school district-based college credits, but on a college campus for every one that has satisfied the requirements for a standard high school diploma. And that's going to pretty significantly limited, and districts will not only will districts not be making money, they will have to be investing some additional of their own funds, which really ties back to this idea of this has been reformatted to focus on where you're using this as a carrot to get kids that otherwise would drop out and not graduate to increase that high school graduation rate.
Okay, we'll hear more about it during the session, but.
Okay, thank you very much. So with that, I would take a
calendar work session.
Oh, I'll delve into a work session on our committee bills. Open work session, introduction of committee measures. Again, as I've told people many times before, and I like to reiterate, voting for this does not indicate whether you are for or against the particular bill. It only indicates that you are we are allowing it to get into the process, be listed as a bill, and then we'll come back and we'll have the conversations and the hearings during the session. So, Senator Canope.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 24, dated 12/3/15. LC 225. LC 125, dated 12/23/15. And LC, we're going to be sure about this?
We're sure.
205, dated 1/13/16.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Canope has moved the introduction of LCs 24, LC 125, and LC 205. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, that passes, and they will get in on to the process. And we'll close our work session. And we'll open an informational session. Some of our people have other commitments, and one person who has been very intimately involved with the Oregon Promise would love to hear the update. So we're going to start with the update on the Oregon Promise.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Knope. My name is Bob Brew, and I am the director of the Office of Student Access and Completion, the financial aid portion of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'm here representing Ben Cannon, our executive director. He sends his regrets. We have a full commission meeting today with a very full agenda, and he is occupied, but he does send his regrets. I'm going to, at this point, just take you briefly through a little bit of the background of the Oregon Promise, not to bore you, but just to make sure we're on the same page as I go forward describing where we are today. Oregon Promise was created under Senate Bill 81, sponsored by Senator Haas. It creates a state program that funds tuition, covers the bulk of the tuition for students that are attending community colleges, primarily right out of high school. It's a last dollar in that it relies on students applying for and applying the Pell Grant or the Oregon Opportunity Grant if they're eligible, and then is a last dollar in to cover any remaining cost. It's administered by the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, primarily out of my office, the Office of Student Access and Completion. The eligibility for the program requires that you the student has to be a resident for 12 months prior to entering community college. They need to complete the application, which we'll get to in a moment, file the federal free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA, or an approved alternative, and they have to have a high school GPA of 2.5 or greater, and we do require a transcript to verify that. They must enroll in an Oregon Community College within 6 months of completing their high school or GED, and they must accept all federal or state grant aid that's offered. To continue in the program after the first year, the student must retain a 2.5 cumulative GPA. They have to make satisfactory academic progress as required by the federal government. And they must enroll at least half time, which are defining as six credits per term. And they must submit a FAFSA or alternative annually and renew their application and submit grade transcripts. Now, if a student falls below a 2.5 GPA cumulative, they're out of the program for a term. If they can pull their grades back up by the following term, then they're reallowed in. In order to be eligible for the program, a student needs to not have completed more than 90 college credits, nor have they completed an associate's degree or a program in career and technical education. The minimum grant is $1,000, and this is for full-time, full-year enrollment. So a student who is only enrolling half-time would be eligible for half that amount. And that's really the students that are whose tuition is fully covered by the Pell or the Oregon Opportunity Grant or a combination thereof. The maximum grant amount is the average tuition charged by the Oregon Community Colleges for 12 credits, or their actual tuition, whichever is less. And students must pay $50 per term as a co-payment to buy into the program. I'm presenting this graph. I know there's a lot of information here, but this basically shows how the Oregon Opportunity Grant starts kicking in as the Pell Grant goes down. As a student's expected family contribution, which is a federal term of art that they use to describe the ability to pay, as that goes up, the Pell Grant decreases. The Oregon Promise Grant comes in to fill that gap to cover the student's tuition costs. For students that are on the left side of that graph that have a higher Pell Grant, they would be eligible for that $1,000 minimum grant under the Oregon Promise, and they can use that for books, transportation, and other related educational costs. Again, this is $1,000 for full year full-time enrollment, so basically $333 a term. If they're half-time, it would be half that. So it's prorated based on their attendance and based on the number of terms, and it's divided by the number of terms they're likely to attend. So the application for the program opened on November 1 and closes on March 1, so it's essentially a four-month open program. There's a paper application that's available, although by far the majority, I don't believe anyone's requested or downloaded a copy of the paper application yet. It's virtually all online. For students that are U.S. citizens, U.S. nationals, or eligible non-citizens, they're required to file the FAFSA. For students that are not, we require them to file the Oregon Student Aid application, the ORSA, and this is only available for students who are not eligible for federal financial aid. And then we require them to upload a copy of their transcripts from the seventh semester, which is the semester that just ended around Christmas time. Here's an example of the application to be in the Oregon Promise. This is the paper application. It has essentially, 8 or 12 data elements, depending on if you count address as one element or four. But basically, we want to find out who they are, where they went to school, and basically make this as simple as possible to get them into the system so they can participate. Here's what the online application looks like. It's very simple. Oregon administers more than 500 privately funded scholarships, so we had a very robust computer system already built, that not only administers our 500 private funded scholarships, but the Chafee Training and Education grants and several other programs. So it was relatively easy for us to build this application right alongside that. So, some key points about the implementation. We had a policy advisory group that included as many stakeholders as we could think of. They met twice and have been queried by email on specific questions. We had a technical advisory group that was primarily made up of financial aid directors, finding out how, if we had this program, how could it actually work in the trenches. And that was very instructional. And we've met with the community college financial aid directors, and we have drafted administrative rules that we expect to have a hearing for in March. We've created the OregonPromise.org and .com, which is where a bulk of our information can be found. There's an Oregon Promise webpage, and that's linked to the HECS webpage and also the OSAC's webpage. There's a toolkit on the webpage with links to flyers, fact sheets, and so on that I'll show you in just a moment. And then there's an outreach and communications plan that we've been developed and implemented. So these are some of the documents that we've created. This one is a flyer that we've hung in high schools across the state. This one we widely distribute at high schools and at college fairs and so on. You can't see it, but there's a frequently asked questions a thing back here, and also a toolkit for advisors. So this is what the applications for Oregon Promise have looked like to date. As you can see, we've got roughly 12,000 applications started and of roughly 7,000 applications begun but not submitted. So there is, as I said, there's a three-part, the application is really three parts. The application itself, the filing of the FAFSA, and the filing of the grade transcripts. A student can submit just the application, and that's what the folks down at the bottom have done, but the folks at the top haven't done that. We don't know yet whether they lost interest or are waiting to be able to submit their FAFSA and their transcripts at the same time. So our cost projections on this modeling, we anticipate that the $10 million that's been allocated for the first year of this program is sufficient to meet the needs of the anticipated applicants. Based on the students that completed or attended community college right out of high school in the 2014-15 school year, roughly 7,800 students were in that group, completed about 9 credits per term, and had roughly a 3.0 GPA. If we took those same students and assumed that they would be eligible for the Oregon Promise, we're projecting that the first year cost would be between $6.3 and $7.6 million. We anticipate that even with an uptick in the number of students, we expect that more students will be interested in community college than were in this cohort prior to the creation of the program. However, that 7,800 students that you see up there were not filtered at all or reduced at all by that 2.5 GPA entrance requirement. So while we expect interest to be up, not every student that wants to go to community college will either apply for Oregon Promise or meet that GPA threshold. So I did a brief worksheet here that kind of shows the roll-up costs for Oregon Promise. Because it's a one-year program, the assumption among some has been, well, it was $10 million for 1 year, the next biennium it will be $20 million. But that's not quite true because it's essentially a two-year program. So if you can see that the first year of this cohort one, it's $10 million this year, and then next biennium, there's $10 million for the second year of the biennium. The second cohort starts, costs $10 million for their first year of the biennium, and $10 million for the second year. And then in the second year of the biennium, the third cohort begins. So even without inflation, even without growth in enrollment and participation, we expect that it would probably be a $40 million program going forward. So some implementation decisions that we've made some of which will be reflected in rules, some of which will be reflected primarily in policy, that the grant will be limited to tuition only. The commission had the choice whether to include mandatory fees in that. In order to limit cost and to acknowledge that there's a great variability in fees among the various community colleges, they determined that it would be best to do tuition only, particularly in this first year of the program. The college credit transcripts and GPA includes not only high school credit, but we count any college credit that they earned while in high school in their GPA. The college credits earned in high school count towards that 90 credit eligibility limit. Students must list at least one community college on their FAFSA in order to participate. If funding isn't available or is reduced in the next biennium, then continuing students will have first priority for those funds. and that the $50 per term co-payment will be deducted from any payment that goes to the student at the start of each term. In other words, we don't award them in any remaining financial aid balance and then ask them to write us a check back. We will be contacting the students that are successful in the program to via email or by text message if allowed. If allowed, we'll do both. If we're not, we don't have permission to text, then we will just notify them by email and through the school portal. Also, schools will be notified of their students that that have been that have met the qualifications to participate. None of this money goes directly to the students, just like any other financial aid. It goes to the financial aid office. They reduce any tuition. They remove, you know, deduct for any tuition fees, other charges that they have. And if there's a balance remaining, then that gets refunded to the student for other expenses. We base the awards on standard enrollment categories. This is very similar to the way the Pell Grant works. It's half-time, three-quarter time, or full-time at 6 credits, 9 credits, and 12 credits, respectively. And then for GED recipients, we base their, remember I said at the beginning, they have to have completed their schooling or within 6 months of enrolling in community college. We base that for GED students. They have to have taken their last test within that six-month window before starting community college. So some of the decisions that are pending, we're looking at what kind of supports can we provide for students once they've enrolled in college, how we will define residency. This gets a little bit tricky because we have a lot of Oregon resident students that live along the border that attend school in Idaho or Nevada or Washington primarily. How we will treat students that graduate early their senior year. They graduate, say, in December of their senior year. Well, the bill calls out that there could be an appeals process for students that fail to meet the 2.5 cumulative GPA due to extenuating circumstances and so on. So we'll have to articulate what process we'll use to adjudicate that. And then how, if at all, we will allow students to regain eligibility to the program if they don't meet the bill requirement that they enroll for 3 terms each consecutive year. The Oregon Promise was, and I don't want to speak for the drafters of the bill, but it was influenced at least in part by the Tennessee Promise, but there are some significant differences that I won't go into here. But I'm including this in the record for your review. And I believe that is it. So I am available for any questions you might have.
Any questions? I had one. Because I clarification in my head and it didn't come up. You clarified part-time because that is a part of the program. How about students that are dual enrolled in a higher institution and community college? Do the credits count towards full-time, part-time? How does that work? Because they're probably going to be they may be attending at both institutions. They may be at the community college getting the higher ed credit.
That's Senator, that conversation. Excuse me. Senator Roblin, thank you for that question. That's exactly, that is one of the remaining tough nuts we're trying to resolve. I believe right now the staff recommendation is that a dual enrolled student has a home school that's the school of record for administering their financial aid, and so on, for ease of use for not only the schools but the federal government and the student. We're considering requesting that the home school needs to be the community college, not the university, and that the Oregon Promise, since it was directly directed towards community college students, that those funds could be used towards the community college portion of their tuition. Now, their enrollment would be cumulative. They're taking 3 credits at one and 6 at another for purposes of the eligibility for the program, they would be considered more than half-time. But for purposes of how the grant dollars would be distributed, they would only go to the community college. Again, this is just initial staff thinking on that.
Okay. And part-time's fine. Half-time minimum?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. And I guess there is one. Has it gone smoother or more difficult than we thought? I mean, I haven't heard much, so it makes it seem like this has been a very smooth process.
Thank you, Senator Roblin. I have to give kudos to my staff that this was they didn't even break stride on this. This was exciting, a new program, and I think an example of where the creation of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission really, it's kind of like working with an all-star team. I mean, we had Dana Richardson helping us on the admin rules side. We had Enda Hartigan helping us with the communication piece. We and my staff down in Eugene just jumped in with both feet. It's been a great pleasure to work on. It's been very exciting, real chance to work together as a coordinated body. I can't say enough about how fun it's been and how exciting.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
Is there anything in the application process that allows you to collect data on kids that aren't meeting that 2.5 GPA and the GPA is the barrier to eligibility?
Chair Roblin, Senator Gelser, not exactly. So we do request they self-report their GPA and then we ask them to submit their transcript. We do have students that self-report their GPA and submit a transcript that has a GPA well below the minimum requirement. So to the extent that we collect that information, we do. But we also recognize that there are a lot of students that know they don't meet the minimums, so don't bother even applying. So while we get partial picture, we don't get the full picture.
And then follow up? What happens when a student is hovering right around that number? So the application date is March 1st, and in that first semester they've maybe had a class that didn't go so well, and their GPA dipped to a 2.4 at that application time. But they do really well in the spring, and they get it back up to a 2.5 or 2.6. Are they still not eligible because of where they were at the end of the first semester of their freshman year, even if they pull it back up?
Chair Roblin, Senator Gelser, thank you for that question. Yes, actually, so we ask students to submit their seventh semester grade transcript. If a student is below that 2.5, we'll still accept their transcript. And in fact, we encourage schools, if they think they're gonna be able to pull that up last semester, go ahead and have them submit, and then we give them the option or the opportunity then after their final grades are recorded to submit their eighth semester transcripts so that they can qualify for the program. So we're doing everything we can to get every eligible student qualified for the program.
Thank you. And I just a comment. I think it would be interesting if there was a way to track who we're losing between that 2.0 and 2.5. I think there's a lot about the background of a student, the expectations, college prep, around the perception of what a 2.5 GPA is or a 2.0 GPA. I mean, a 2.0 is still passing, that's average, and if we look at 40-40-20, wanting to move those kids for whom school may be hard, but there could be a two-year degree that they're fantastic at. My guess would be that in that 2.0 to 2.5, you're going to have a lot of ELL kids, a lot of special ed kids that have graduated in 4 years with a regular diploma, lower income kids that haven't had the advantages to be able to have a tutor to help pull them up in that Algebra 2. So that just looking at that equity of who's able to access this. I don't know if there's a way to track this in these first years so we can make sure we're being equitable and meeting the highest risk, highest need kids.
Senator Roblin, Senator Gelser, yes, thank you. The for being such a small, short application, I think there's going to be a lot of data that we'll be able to mine. We're already looking at what schools and school districts are we not hearing from in terms of the application process. What schools are there? Are we hearing from more young ladies than young men? Are we hearing from the students of different ethnicities at different rates than we would expect to? So I think we'll be able to mine it, not to the level of GPA, since we don't probably see the bulk of students that have a GPA less than 2.5. We probably won't see that, but we'll be able to see where we will be able to gather some data.
I wonder if that's something we could get from the Department of Ed, if they, or from high schools. I know my district has sent this to me. Both of my high schools have said, this is the number of kids that we have that want to go to college next year that are under a 2.5. It would just be interesting to be able to know and then be able to figure out what the cost would be and the appropriate mechanism to serve them.
We'll ask them. They're here later. We can ask them to think about it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we're going to close that hearing, informational hearing. One next person, Representative Doherty, do you want to come up and give a presentation about a bill introduction that's happening in the House that you wanted to have us know about at least, and then we'll go to higher ed.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Roblin, Vice Chair Knope, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Margaret Doherty. I am the state representative for House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. And I'll be very brief. The bill concept coming in as a committee bill is relating to procedures relating to what we call hostile education environments. And what that is basically is a bullying bill. And currently, school districts, the law deals with school districts that have policies on bullying, especially, and they've added things like cyberbullying and harassment and intimidation. And school districts are required to have a procedure to deal with this and to report the information to ODE and the community. And what this bill would do is it would direct the State Board of Ed to adopt by rule a complaint process by which individuals are able to report a district policy that is alleging violation of state law, and in other words, they have not followed through on what their own policy is. And especially with cyberbullying, it is becoming a huge problem. And one of the reasons this was brought up was in my own school district, Tiger Tualatin, they have a policy that deals with cyberbullying off of campus, which is where most of it happens. And so the whole idea and purpose behind this is to give the Oregon Department of Ed, and by the way, we worked with all the parties involved to get this bill together, is to go through and to adopt rules so we can go through and evaluate and report on the different kinds of bullying they've had, and possibly having some sort of like a place people can go and say, okay, if this has happened in my school district, we did this and it's been very successful to try to stop it. And so it's the whole idea of trying to be preventative, trying to get information to school districts so they can deal with the issue of bullying, especially when it comes to cyberbullying. So very short, that's what it is. And we have worked with the ODE. We've worked with various groups of children, whether it be racial, whether it be gender identity, that kind of things, of groups that have been victims of bullying. We'll never get rid of it, but hopefully we can go through and help the kids a little bit.
Any questions for? Okay.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen and ladies, very much.
So we'll close that public hearing. And now we're going to open an informational hearing on retention and graduation rates for university students. And I want to, as Dr. Ray is coming up, thank him for graciously allowing a few of the others to go ahead, because that was the earlier, so that we could hear the other presentation. So thank you, Dr. Ray, and thank you for being here. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Knott, members of the committee. Thank you very much for giving us brief time to speak to you. You have three pretty terrific, dynamic young colleagues here and an old man, so the old man will try to do his part pretty quickly and set the stage for some of what they'll be talking about. You can see the screen. The next slide introduces all of us. I'm Ed Ray, president of Oregon State University. My colleagues will introduce themselves as they speak. What I want to do, just very briefly, is mention sort of the areas that we're asking for support from the legislature this session. It includes an ask for $15 million in additional state support for our general fund so that we can ratchet even further along on a completion and a student success agenda. I'll say more about that in a moment. We're also seeking renewal of the University Venture Development Fund tax credit, constitutional amendment to fulfill Senate Bill 270 requirements to enable universities to invest some of their portfolio inequities, although today might not be the day that you want to do it, to be able to invest in select emergency capital projects. Basically, I think these are at PSU, Southern, and OIT, but all seven universities are supportive of the need for that that work to be done, and we're asking generally that a discussion group be brought together to review the CSL that's being applied to the universities, 3.3% for the biennium versus 7% for state agencies. We think there's fertile ground for discussion there about how appropriate those numbers are, but we're asking for a discussion on it. With respect to the $15 million, we want, with additional monies, to really focus on students after their first year in college. There are some 40% of students who finish their first year in perfectly fine academic standing who never get a college degree. And there are personal reasons, but there are also financial reasons. About half of the students who never graduate stop out in their sophomore, junior, senior years. But with a little financial support, with a little academic advising, other kinds of services, we think we can have much more success with those students. And if you look at the next slide, it just indicates proven practices that help students be more successful in persisting through to graduation, emergency funds for students who are close to finishing but can't manage it, financially experiential learning, summer bridge programs, completer scholarships. All of these practices, as I said, are proven, and we're committed to advancing our efforts in those regards. We're hoping that the legislature can approve the additional $15 million in general funds that we'll be seeking. So let me stop there and let my colleagues share their thoughts with you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Poole. I work in the Academic Advising and Learning Center at Western Oregon University as a university student success specialist. I'm also the system administrator for Western's Student Success Network. I also hold a non-tenure track assistant professorship in the Department of Criminal Justice. I'm here today to advocate for the needs of my fellow students who experience hardship during their time in college. I say fellow students because I'm a three-time alum from WOU. And when I came to Western, I too found myself struggling to complete college due to personal and financial circumstances outside of my control. One of the most common things we forget is that life continues to happen while students go to school. Life doesn't slow down, it doesn't pull over, and it doesn't pause and wait for us to finish. While we know there is no silver bullet that will fix all of the issues students experience while in college, there are things we as an institution and as a state can do to significantly increase a student's chance of success. One example is the use of an early alert and intervention program designed to identify students who are at risk of failing or attrition. In 2012, Western implemented such a program. Knowing that this program would undergo scrutiny, I drafted a research proposal and received Institutional Review Board approval to conduct a quantitative analysis of the program during the first five terms it was implemented. In short, faculty and staff identified 672 students who were at risk of failing or attrition. Of the 672 students, 279, or 42%, responded and met with a student success specialist or an academic advisor to address the academic concerns. Of the 279 students who received an intervention, 49%, or 137, were considered successful for that term, compared to only 41% of the student population who did not respond to a request for help, which is a difference of 8%. While the data does not support causation, it does show a strong correlation between increased levels of engagement and student success. Ultimately, positive, targeted, intrusive advising works. Early alert systems work. Emergency fund programs, if utilized correctly, work. Online study tools work. These interactions allow us to create meaningful connections and expose students to tutoring, online study tools, time management skills, and other campus resources they may have otherwise not known about. The funding we're asking for is not for experimental programs. These are initiatives that have been shown to reduce achievement gaps, help students persist to graduation, and reduce student loan debts. I've seen firsthand how these types of programs and initiatives can impact students' lives and help them graduate. Thank you for your time, and I'll take any questions.
We'll let the panel go through, and then we'll take questions.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Knope, and the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Tori Uhara, and I speak to you today as the chair of the board of directors for the Oregon Student Association, as well as the student body president of Southern Oregon University, where I'm currently a senior receiving my business degree with a concentration in hospitality and also pursuing a certificate in nonprofits. I'm here today because I see my peers across the state struggling. I have known students with bright futures who've had to cease pursuing higher education because the cost of tuition has risen more than 20% at most of our universities over the past 5 years, and is set to go up even more next year. And we know that folks at community colleges have experienced similar increases. I'm here because the average student that graduates has $30,000 in debt in Oregon. That doesn't even address those who take on debt but never finish. I'm here because the cost of textbooks is out of control. Students at SOU have reported spending in excess of $300 on textbooks in a single term. I'm here because students are being priced out of attending SOU because of the cost of rent is prohibitively high in Ashland, and vacancy rates are so low in this state that even those who have lived here for many years struggle to find housing. While the challenges that face our state are many in number, the state of Oregon can do better for students in post-secondary education. We can do better for students across the state by targeting our money in places that will help those most in need and create the greatest impact. Earlier this year, I was approached by one of my student leaders in tears because they would be unable to continue at SOU due to how much they owed to the university after being unsuccessful in mitigating their housing costs, tuition, and lacking the parental support that our current financial aid system assumes. This is a student who has a job, is involved in both local on-campus and off-campus in student leadership, and is on track to graduate. I worked with them in my capacity as student body president to gain the necessary resources for them to stay at SOU, but I know that many of my peers would not know who to call or be able to utilize the resources this student was to stay in school. This funding is targeting folks like them, who are in the 35% of students who find themselves in the murky middle. While many initiatives target first-year students, nationwide data shows that 52% of attrition occurs after the first year, with a large majority of attrition occurring during the sophomore and junior years. Students in the murky middle can be overlooked because they do not exhibit the obvious at-risk factors and therefore are difficult to distinguish from those who do ultimately graduate. Funding will be targeted at the two-fifths of students who are able to finish their first year in good academic standing, but for various reasons do not complete their education. This effort will also help reduce the growing student debt load borne by Oregonians who are unable to graduate. We are also targeting the expansion of community college advising and the pursuit of better programs to help more of those students don graduation caps. All this is why I urge the committee to support the College Completion Initiative, which focuses $15 million to universities and $10 million to community colleges to help Oregon students reach success. Thank you for your time. Thank you.
Sorry, I was cold. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, the members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Juan Alvaro, and I am a member of of the Oregon Student Association and a student of Western Oregon University. I'm here to ask you to support the College Completion Initiative. The reason why I am here is because I believe that $15 million in emergency funds for students who are struggling to complete their education would make a huge difference. I know because it would have helped me in my own financial situation. I know I received a lot of scholarships for Western Oregon University, but it still was not enough to completely remove all that I had to pay. The task of working near full time with school just to pay off my tuition was not easy at all. Each term, when I was close to finishing off paying off other previous terms, the next term's cost just rolled over and it put me right back in the same spot. I commit about half my paycheck just to try to pay it off and just try not to get in that endless debt. It's never enough. What makes it worse is that I'm always fighting to pay off my debt. This is hard because I have to make sacrifices, which have included not enough money for food or not even being able to pay for rent. Why I do this is because if I don't pay off 2/3 of my balance, I'm unable to register for the next term. This past fall term, I owed too much money and I had family issues, so I was unable to pay because my family has to go first and they have to get for health issues and stuff. This caused a huge problem for me because this meant I was not able to register for classes on time, and I ruined my graduation timeline. I didn't get a chance to register and fix my classes until after Christmas. I am a senior, and I'm supposed to have like first dibs on all the credits because I'm graduating. It's a good old time. this situation has caused me to delay graduation because I had needed to take a core class that I did not get in, and it just domino effect it all the way down. Classes go on and it ruined the timeline for my senior internship. That means I have to wait another term. I have to spend 3 more months just waiting to take one more class that could be used in the workforce instead. Of course, this is just my story, right? I'm just one story. I know countless students that face this harsh reality with me, and the fact that we have to choose to eat or to pay our tuition is unsettling and should not be an option. This is unacceptable and should not be a question to anyone, much less students who are just looking to further their education. I urge you to accolade $15 million to completion initiatives. As students, we should not have to lose sleep or get overwhelmed with the stress just because of the money. Instead, we should be getting that sleep and studying on the best of our abilities to help our communities. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions for the students?
I guess I will say last session when we were working on the budget and we took the Ways and Means process around the state, if there was one statement that came clear and true from all the students, it was this whole idea of debt and raising of tuition costs, which continues to build on that. And I have a daughter who has a lot bigger debt than that, and it does make it difficult as you move forward in your life. It's difficult to have a loan for a home even though you have nothing other than your education for it. And so getting the next start and actually becoming that producer in the society that puts money back into taxes and other things becomes harder just because of your debt. So I think we all recognize that. We will look carefully, and I know in education we keep trying. There are a lot of meetings happening around the Capitol right now, all considering the kinds of costs that are there. And we also know that we have costs that are coming forward because of things that we've done that move forward, which will make allocating that difficult. But I will commit that a number of us will continue to try to figure out if we can find that $15 million. And I think the fact that they're focusing it on retention of students is a really big issue for us. We want to cut that cost down. And we do know that the most expensive debt is that doesn't come with a degree. So figuring that out will be really important. And I appreciate you taking your time and energies to come here and talk to us. I wish you a lot of success at Western and at Central and in your job and at Western. So any further questions for any of the other? Okay. Thank you very much for being here. It is really appreciated.
Thank you.
I will close that. Information Lee.
Thank you.
Are they here?
He's not here.
I didn't have sound
before.
So with that, I think we're going to stand at ease for a minute. We're waiting for our next speaker.
She's running
a
committee. That's right. That's what I'd say.
We're going to reconvene the Education Committee meeting, and at this time, we're going to open an informational meeting on the Department of Education with an update, and with that, we will invite Salam and whoever he wants with him to come on up front. And I see them shaking their heads, so I guess it's just you, Salam.
Leaving you alone.
And earlier we had a question, and we'll let Senator Gelser ask it towards the end about.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that question. You're so smart.
All right. If I could just move this a little closer. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Oregon Department of Education. And I appreciate the opportunity to provide you some information on something that I hope is of interest to you, which is the reauthorized Elementary Secondary Education Act. I thought maybe I use this as an opportunity to bring you up to speed on where we are relative to the act itself, the process, and what it actually means for us. So I have a PowerPoint presentation, and I know you're trying to go paperless, but I do have copies of it if you would like.
Sure.
And I know it's not good teaching practice to give it in advance. I should wait till the end.
You should wait till the end.
But if you would like, I can provide you with that. Thank you. So I also want to apologize in advance. There is a lot of dense information in this PowerPoint presentation. It's really intended to go out for our schools and districts next week. So they have the same information that we have at the department. But I'll try to go through it as quickly as I can.
This does look smaller than the bill.
It is much smaller than the bill. It's the super condensed version, if you will. So it's a bill, I would say, that we're very excited about because I think it gives us an opportunity to pause, to reflect on the work that we have done over the last 15 years under the No Child Left Behind Act, and to think about the future and where we want to go with it. So I want to share with you the content of the bill, highly summarized, if you will, to share with you our plan, the time frame, and ultimately the plan that we will have by August of 2016. And if there is time, I'd love to share with you a couple of slides relative to our work on high school graduation, because I know that is something of importance to you and to all of us. So with that, Mr. Chair, if I may begin.
Please.
Okay. Again, lots of information. I promise to go through it really quickly. So I'm going to skip this slide, actually, and the next one. Basically, this is the timeline for the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. As you will know, it was passed in December and signed by the President in December, and we're about a month into interpreting, analyzing, and really understanding what the Act calls on us to do and the opportunities that have been afforded to us. The one thing that I would underscore here is that the reauthorization period is 2017 through 2020 with the understanding that the Congress can come back and make some modifications and amendments to it after implementation. So moving on, some of the highlights is that the Act maintains annual assessments, but it provides an opportunity for seven states to be pilot sites for different types of assessments, and we're interested in exploring that option depending on what it really entails. It does give us increased flexibility to design school accountability systems, school interventions, and student supports, and I'll talk more about those here briefly. And it does give us flexibility to work with our local stakeholders to develop educator evaluation and support system, the educator effectiveness opportunity that is under our waiver. We've done some great work in that area, and our intention is to move it forward, but with a process that allows us to make some tweaks and modifications to it if our partners and stakeholders feel that that is necessary. And it also gives us some flexibility on the use of the federal funds. So currently, if a student is a poor student and they're a language learner, you couldn't actually commingle those two sources of funds. Under the reauthorized act, you can actually commingle those funds and use them in a more blended and effective way to help support that student, because ultimately you're providing services, and some of those services were duplicative, but you couldn't pay for them from either pot. Under this new law, that is permitted, which is good news for us, and it's good news for school districts, because typically those are one and the same. It maintains our commitment to academic standards, high academic standards and expectations for all students, what we call college and career readiness standards, and also alignment to higher education. So it provides us an opportunity to continue to align our system. So we're talking about a P20 and making sure that students have the knowledge and skills that will help them be successful in that next step, whether they go directly to the workforce, they go to a community college, university, private school, et cetera. Okay. Again, if you want to stop me at any point with questions, I'm happy to take them, but I want to try and get through the dense part first and then welcome any questions, comments, and suggestions from you. On the assessment side, it does require testing in math and reading and language arts in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school, and it adds science at every grade level, so once in elementary, once in middle school, and once in high school. Senator Knope, you asked me a couple of times ago when I was before this committee if we can use different assessments at the high school level in particular. I think you mentioned SAT or ACT. The law now allows us to do that. In the past, we were restricted to the assessment that was developed by the state. Now we have an opportunity to develop a process at the state level that schools can use to determine to get approval to take a different for students to take a different assessment.
Senator Knope.
So does that require action by the board to do that, or by the department, or does the legislature
Chair Roblin, Senator Knope, it does require the state to set up a process that the local school districts can use to request the use of a different assessment. So we're excited about this. I think it affords us an opportunity to think about assessment at the high school level in particular in a different way. We will work with the field to develop the process for doing so, and much of it will be influenced by the guidance that we get from the U.S. Department of Education. So currently, our state assessment has to go through a rigorous process that's called peer review. So the U.S. Department of Education looks at it, it gets evaluated by experts across the country, and they determine that it's of what they call sufficiency to be approved as a state assessment. So let's say if we choose to go with one of the nationally normed assessments like SAT or ACT, they would have to go through the same process. The U.S. Department of Education would say, yes, this is a sound assessment, it's aligned to the content standards, and Oregon State can use it. So I don't want to paint a rather arduous picture. I think the process, we'll go through it. Once we determine that we want to do something different than what we currently do, we'll go through the process and we'll make that available to schools. So we're committed to doing that.
A follow-up on that question then. Can it be a situation where you have two different assessments and different school districts could choose different options, or would it have to be the same for every school?
Yeah. Senator Roblin, that's a great question, and that's one of the things that we have to ponder. So I'm of the opinion that it could potentially be a menu of options.
Okay.
So it could be some districts now, we know in, let's say, the Bend Lapine School District and the Beaverton School District, they use ACT and they make it available to all students. So we don't want to alter the practice so it harms them or their students. So we have to think through that. The challenge is going to be the technical aspects of that, the data collection, making sure that you have reliability, especially when we compare districts and schools to one another and students' performance across the state. So right now, we'll explore all of those options, and we will do what's feasible and what will keep will serve students the best way. What I would like you to hear is that we're not walking into this with a predisposed notion as to which assessment it will be or it ought to be. We are honestly open to the process that we're going to go through, and we will let our practitioners inform our thinking and our decision making. Ultimately, Senator Knope, to answer your question, the board will have to take action on this because this becomes the state plan It will be signed by the governor, submitted to the U.S. Department of Education, and the board will adopt it as the state plan. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Excellent. So we will have to develop the technical criteria and the process, and then I'm not going to forecast too much because it may not be able to happen. The 95 participation rate, still part of the new law, and it specifies that every subgroup now has to meet that 95 participation rate. It calls on states to create their own opt-out policy, and we have that in place already.
So question on that one. Mm-hmm. Have they kept the N for a subgroup the same? I mean, it's such a small number when you get at the bottom. I mean, I think it's, is it 10? How many kids have to be in a subgroup in a school?
It depends. I think, Senator Roblin, it could be 7. It depends.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah,
that was
it's pretty small. Yeah.
So, I mean, the issue there is if it is 7, mm-hmm. then you have to get 100%. You
right.
can't get to the 95 if right. any one of those people missed the
yeah.
test.
Right.
And there's
right.
So many reasons that
yeah.
can happen.
Right.
It just makes it very frustrating for some of us when any subgroup fails, you failed. And somebody was sick, or anyway, there's just
mm-hmm. yeah.
If the N was a little larger, it would be much easier for
right.
me to deal with this.
Right.
I mean, 20 and one misses, you're still at 90. That's 95. So,
yeah.
If you don't have an N of 20,
right.
you can't lose a single person, and that's really hard for smaller schools.
Right. Senator Roblin, members of the committee, I think the N in terms of participation is not that closely defined. The N is defined in terms of the privacy that we need to afford students.
I understand
so when
that.
We actually calculate the data, but in terms of participation, it depends on the number of students that are eligible to take the assessment. And you're absolutely right. In some cases, a fraction could have a tremendous impact on whether that school meets the 95% or not. However, there's good news in terms of where that criteria fits into the overall accountability system. So if I may just touch on this
please.
Slide, because I think it starts to answer the question. Because right now, when we think about accountability, unfortunately, we've become really conditioned to think exclusively about the test. That's all we think about when we think about accountability. We have a report card that's much more comprehensive than just a single test. But we rate school performance, student performance, and even teacher performance on the basis of a single test. So we have an opportunity, I think, to really expand our thinking and our framework relative to what we mean by accountability. So this law gives us the opportunity to create accountability systems that have both academic and non-academic indicators. So we will still put great value on the achievement of students relative to state assessments, whether it's SBAC, ACT, SAT, et cetera, but it does give us other options to consider when we're casting judgments on schools and the education in that school. So the academic indicators are the achievement on state tests, student growth, which is really important for us as a state, English language proficiency for English language students. And I would say this is significant for the academic indicators because those were a separate accountability system that was part of the old law. So now they're all folded together, which is an enhancement, in my opinion, and graduation rates at the high school level. There are school quality or student success indicators that are really more qualitative in nature. So it could be, and we would create a menu of options for schools to identify and select from. And it could be activities such as student engagement, and it could be in-school activities or out-of-school activities, so the number of students that participate in career-related learning standards, that participate in internships and those types of activities. It could be the number of students that actually obtain a credential. It could be a CTE credential while in high school. It could be school climate. It could be the number of CTE opportunities that we afford students, the number of AP courses that are available to the students. So lots of different things that can really describe that are pride points for schools and districts throughout the state. So we will capture those as part of the accountability framework instead of exclusively putting everything on the achievement, the achievement based on the test. And that is, I think that gets at your question, Senator Roblin, that it expands our thinking and it's not just the test and we're putting everything on that one test. So it de-emphasizes testing, I believe. Okay. Next slide, continuing with accountability. The law does call on us to weigh the indicators. So the indicators that I just went over, we would have to weight them. And currently, to give you an example and a contrast, if you will, 100% of the weight in our accountability system, in our report card, is put on the academic indicators. And it's split 25% for achievement, 50% for growth, and 25% for subgroup achievement. So 100% of it is placed on achievement based on the state test. This gives us an opportunity to expand this and to include the academic and non-academic indicators. We will still have to deal with the 95 participation rate and how to weigh that within those indicators, and we will still have to manage the opt-out process that we currently have in our state. And again, that will be an open, public, transparent process. Okay. I want to move to school improvement. The last bullet here that talks about states are required to meaningfully differentiate all public schools on an annual basis. That distinction, I think, will be based on the academic achievement, because that's how we will do it within the Title I category. So once we identify those schools, the law still calls on us to maintain our priority and focus schools. And the priority and focus schools are those schools that are in the bottom 5% of our low-performing schools. So currently, we do that based on a four-year cycle. This requires us to do it on a three-year cycle. And graduation is part of that configuration now. So in the past, it was exclusively based on academic performance, and it was limited to Title I. This limits it to Title I, but the only thing that's different is high schools, regardless whether they are a Title I high school or not, if their graduation rate is below 67%, they're eligible to receive services. And the way we're approaching this is really in a partnership-like manner. This is an opportunity to engage with schools and districts. It's an opportunity to provide supports and resources to them. I'll talk here in a minute about the funding that will be available for those schools and districts to access to help them get out of that low-performing category. And we're not going to label schools. I think calling schools focus and priority puts a different image in one's mind. And what we have done over the last 3 years plus is provided a lot of support to those schools to help them get out of that category. And we have lots of data and anecdotal stories that we can share with you about how much schools really value that. We have schools now that want to exit from that category, but many are asking us, can we continue, because we want to be able to access that coach, we want to be able to access the targeted professional development, we want to continue to be with a group of schools that are going through similar challenges to learn together and do joint professional development. So I just want to put a positive note there, because yes, it's based on low performance, but our approach is going to be positive and constructive. We also have to annually notify districts when one or more subgroup of students are consistently underperforming. So we're looking at the district data as an aggregate, but we also have to watch for the performance of individual subgroups. Okay. School improvement, this is where I suggested that we will have some resources that will be available to us. Currently, school improvement grants come directly from the U.S. Department of Education, and we issue those grants to priority and focus schools. So the school improvement grants are being eliminated. However, we have been given the opportunity to increase our set-aside from 4% to 7%. So you may look at that and say, well, you're going to have more money to spend. In actuality, it's going to be the same, because they take away the school improvement grants, and they just give us permission to increase our set-aside by 3%. This is the money that goes to schools to support the focus and priority schools, to pay for coaches, to pay for mentors, to pay for professional development, and to support the schools in making the transformation they need to be highly successful. We also have the option of reserving up to 3% for direct student services, such as credit recovery, advanced placement, tutoring, transportation for public school choice, et cetera. And this is a new category that gives us some flexibility in terms of promoting certain practices that we want to see in our state. Talked a little bit about the report card. I won't go into this into great detail, but again, these are some of the indicators that will be included in the report card. I think the report card could really become the accountability framework that we use in Oregon, instead of just focusing on one test, one shot per year. The school quality and the student success indicators will be folded into the report card. Again, climate, nationally certified teachers, counseling, CTE, advanced placement courses. Those are the types of things that we would identify on a list of for schools to select from and to brag about their schools and brag about their work and the success of their students. The teacher quality and evaluation component is part of the new law. The law ends the highly qualified teacher requirement. However, it's something that many schools and districts have invested in, so we would give them opportunities to handle that any way they choose to, but it will not be a requirement that we have to report to the federal government. We also see the law ending federal mandates on educator evaluation. So Senate Bill 290 is currently an Oregon administrative rule. Many of those practices are currently in place. We want to reconvene the group that worked on those and to have some discussions about, you know, do we maintain what we have? Do we need to make some modifications? And we want practitioners to help us in those conversations and policymakers like yourself and others. So we have an opportunity, instead of just saying we're going to stop doing all of this, we're going to say we've done this for about 5 years now. We have really good history and good track record in the value and purpose of evaluation, which is really to facilitate better interaction between teachers and principals. So teachers are getting ongoing feedback, meaningful constructive feedback relative to their practice, and principals knowing what teachers need so they can be supported through professional development and other means. So we're going to look at that in a very thoughtful and methodical way. We're going to bring back the group that put those together and say to them, we have an opportunity to revisit. And let's go from there. So I want to underscore that, because that was a tremendous investment on your part, and I want to assure you that we're not going to throw things out. We're going to look at them carefully and move forward in an informed way. I'm really excited about this section of the law. I'm excited about the fact that it's called Well-Rounded Education. Title IV of No Child Left Behind focused exclusively on 21st century learning community grants. And these were primarily after-school grants that were given to districts and community organizations in partnership to support student learning after school. This law calls out things that I know are really important to us, which is a comprehensive educational system, well-rounded education that we want to afford to every student in our state. So things like advanced placement, international baccalaureate, STEM programs, music and arts, which is music to my ears, computer science, and other disciplines are now allowable expenditures under the law. Under Title IIA, under NCLB, Title IIA, for example, was used exclusively for teachers in language arts and mathematics. You couldn't do anything beyond those two subjects. So under this new law, we have an opportunity to expand the offerings that we have for students. But most exciting for me is the opportunity to have a different conversation. So when we talk about ESSA, Every Student Succeeds Act, we're not just talking about math and language arts. We have the opportunity to talk about the arts and humanities and computer science and other disciplines. It also provides resources for safe and healthy schools. We know that is something that contributes to student success, and the effective use of technology, which is something that we started to expand in our agency. And these are some other provisions. I will not actually bore you with these, but I think there are some other areas that we see an expansion and a welcome expansion in the law. Let me go over the timelines really quickly. So the waiver that we are currently under expires in August of 2016, and we intend to continue to support the schools that are identified as focus and priority until the new law takes effect, which is 2017-18 school year. The new accountability system goes into effect in 2017-18, but the new law actually takes effect in August of 2016, and we're trying to figure out what this transition timeline is going to be like, and we're waiting for guidance from the U.S. Department of Education on how to do that, because some programs expire and you have to continue them, and if you don't have rules and regulations, then you know we want to make sure that we're consistent in what we're doing. So our plan is to have a draft plan ready by August of 2016, and in order to do that, we started an internal process first off to really get the best experts relative to the different sections of the law together within the agency, working cross teams, cross offices. We've actually invited other agency partners, like from the Chief Education Office and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, to be a part of this work group to really start analyzing the law and understanding what it directs us to do. And then between February and May, we're going to have a public engagement process. We're going to reach out to different stakeholders around the state. We will have an advisory committee. We will have a technical committee. We will be engaging teachers, administrators, community members at large. We are literally going to canvas the state and be in every community as much as we possibly can to hear from parents, teachers, students, community members, et cetera. We will have a draft by May, July, between May and July, and hopefully have a complete draft by August of 2016. The guidance from the U.S. Department of Education says regulations will be done by October of 2016. If they're done prior to that and we have an opportunity to submit, we will, but we want to wait until the guidance is complete so we don't have to redo things or renegotiate things with the U.S. Department of Education. So our rollout plan is for 16-17 is develop policy guidance, administrative rules, and I think that's where the legislature comes into play as well. We will keep you informed of our work and we'll provide you regular update as we go along, but we will probably come back to you in 2017 requesting either regulation, new laws or modification of existing laws to accommodate our state plan. And 17-18 will be the implementation year. Okay. So if I may, I'd be happy to stop here and see if you have any questions. And I have just two slides on graduation, which doesn't give it the attention it deserves. But
any questions?
I'll be mindful of your time.
That's good.
Yeah, I appreciate the
nice, yeah,
succinct way we've done it. I've attempted to look at the bill a few times, and I'm happy other people are.
So we are. So,
yes.
So are we. Actually, we are really pleased that others are willing to take the 1,300 pages and condense them down to a few pages. Yeah. So
well, thank you.
Right.
Okay. I think we're good.
All right.
We'll go on to graduation.
Graduation. So graduation is something that we all have been hearing about. It's something that we're all concerned about. Our state doesn't fare well compared to other states. And that's debatable at times because graduation requirements vary from place to place. But nonetheless, we want to be in the forefront of that. We want to be recognized as a leading state, not just to graduation, but everything else that we do. So I know that is something that you and the legislature in general is concerned about, and I just want to tell you that we do share that concern, and we intend to do something about it. So when we think about improving graduation, we know that these practices make a difference relative to student engagement. The career and technical education funding and support that you provided in the last legislative session, $35 million, I think is a tremendous investment. I think STEM education also helps engage students, and I believe it also engages teachers in the teaching and learning process and makes education and teaching fun. The expansion of the accelerated learning opportunities and participation, including AP, IB, Dual Credit, Regional Promise, the Oregon Promise, I think those all provide opportunities for students to think about their future and opportunities to start engaging more in school. In terms of the system itself, the college and career readiness standards, the focus on integration of early learning and child nutrition and full-day kindergarten, the focus on tracking our students' progress. Are they on track, attendance, and are they on track to graduate by ninth grade? Addressing the absenteeism, addressing the academic struggles and challenges that they're facing. And the planning and the relationships are part of that equation. The education plan and profile, we're trying to put more attention to that. We are in the process of hiring a guidance and counseling specialist that will be a college and career readiness specialist. And it's a redirecting of resources. It's not really new resources that we have, but we feel that we need somebody that's going to help schools and districts work with them on their bridge programs and transition programs. And we know the value of mentor programs and partnerships for both teachers and schools and students in general. So we are actually trying to approach this very methodically. We're trying to get practitioner voice into this in every way we possibly can, starting with teachers, with administrators. We want to get communities involved in the conversation. We know what contributes to dropping out. We know what contributes to not completing, not graduating, or delayed graduation. We also know what contributes to success. So that is not a mystery by any means. The question is, how do you mobilize that at the local level? How do you operationalize that at a school level? How do we help principals identify the key challenges and areas that they need to focus on and to work within their school and district to actually get there? I believe that is the challenge. So we have a teacher advisory panel that we meet with, that we will meet with quarterly, and we're going to put this question to them. So as practitioners, as classroom practitioners that work with students every day, we want them to tell us what are the barriers and what are the things that are actually contribute to student success. We formed the graduation advisory committee. It started with a handful of people. I think I have maybe 50 people on the committee now because everybody wants to be on it. We have principals of the leading principals of high schools that we're calling are beating the odds. So schools that are leading the state in graduation, we've invited those principals to be on this committee, and we're going to rely on them to tell us what they're doing to help improve graduation in their schools and districts. We're going to look at research both in-state and out-of-state and nationally, and we're going to develop essentially a set of recommendations for schools to implement in order to improve graduation. And we will get at many of the issues that, that you and your colleagues have been concerned about in terms of absenteeism, attendance, academic success, et cetera. So our goal is to actually have a plan, and from that plan, we will likely have some policy recommendations to the State Board of Education. There may be some recommendations to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission relative to entrance and admission and retention. And I know that there will be some recommendations that we may bring to you and ask your assistance with. But we want to be focused. We want to be targeted. We want to be intentional. Our goal to get this done in 6 to 9 months at the most, because, again, we know what the variables are. We know what the factors are. We just have to help schools implement and provide them the resources and the supports to do so. So I just want to share with you that we are working on this. We're taking it seriously. We're working on it with a sense of purpose and intentionality, and the connections to the ESSA actually helps us because it allows us to identify those schools and it allows us to put some federal dollars into those schools. So, Mr. Chair, I will stop here, and I welcome any questions, comments, suggestions from the committee.
Any suggestions or comments with respect to the graduation issues? Sarah, do you want to ask a question about kids will have a 2.5 or under?
Yes. So we were talking earlier about the implementation of Oregon Promise and how we might collect data on kids that have a GPA that's below 2.5 that would do well in community college, that want to pursue community college, but are ineligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant because of that GPA, and specifically figuring out if that GPA disproportionately impacts low-income ELL and students with disabilities.
No. Just ask me to figure out if there's a data
question
wasted.
Chair Oberlin, Senator Geltzer, I don't believe that we collect that information. We collect completion information and the time frame for completion. So based on cohort data, did the student actually complete within 4 years, 5 years? I don't believe, I could be wrong, but I don't believe collecting that the agency or the state actually collects grade point averages. When I was in the Salem-Keizer School District, I don't recall submitting data to that effect. But I will share with you that that would be tremendously challenging, simply because there isn't a mechanism for us to do that. And it would be really burdensome on districts to collect GPAs and submit them to the state. I would also add, if I may, that the GPA kind of, let's say the 2.5 cutoff score, let's say, it's going to vary tremendously. So a 2.5 in one district may not be the equivalent of a 2.5 in another district. And I would just encourage the committee to consider that if you choose to move in that direction. So it's not a totally reliable indicator, I would say. It might be a screener, but academically it may not be a reliable indicator. There may be others.
Follow up?
Sure.
Student with a 2.4, does that mean they're a bad student that isn't going to succeed after high school?
Senator Roblin, Senator Geltzer, absolutely not. I think students, you know, you've heard the old adage that, you know, C students are actually running the world. So I would never suggest that a student with a 2.4 or a 3.0 or a 1.0, I think the circumstances vary tremendously, and every student's circumstances and needs have to be considered individually. So I would not actually cast a judgment as to what really constitutes a good student, if it's a 2.4 or a 3.5 or a 4.0. I think if we're using that as the category to judge whether the student is prepared for further support, if you will, or a different opportunity, all I'm suggesting is that it may not be totally reliable. And we may need to consider a complement of indicators and not just that.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I think you raise a good issue, as does Senator Gelser, and that's when we put the Oregon Promise together, that was a starting place, but it may not be the right place. In fact, it, a better way might tie into your opportunities for new assessment if you're using the ACT or the it might be, but that would be a nice encouragement for people to take them, and mm-hmm. theoretically that is the predictor for college performance. So you would encourage people to hit that 95% target then, rather than mandating it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Chair Roland, Senator Beyer, I think what you're referring to is creating incentives for students and parents to want to take the assessment, and that's definitely one of the principles we're using to think about assessment and accountability in general, that it really needs to incentivize students to do something rather than the opposite.
So follow up, just curiosity, if districts choose to move towards one of the two tests, mm-hmm. Would those the costs of taking those tests be covered then by public funds?
Chair Roblin, Senator Beyer, I think that's one of the issues that we have to look at. Ideally, I'll tell you my preference, ideally is that if we choose one or more than one, that the state actually be the contractor for that assessment. So the results are provided to the state, we can compare them to other, we can actually have them all together in one place with the K-8 data, if you will. I think managing the testing is what we have to look at. So do we rely on individual districts to manage that and submit the data to us? Can we create a platform where everything goes in together? We have to look at testing windows, because SAT and ACT are giving in certain windows at certain times of the year. The testing window currently is open from February to May, so we would have to negotiate that with the providers. Are they willing to keep it open from February to May? All of these technical pieces we will look at. But we share your sentiment that we need to incentivize students to take the assessment, because it has value, it has relevance, not just to them, but to their parents and to the post-secondary institution. And if I may add just one more thing, the state administers the PSAT. And that might be an interesting indicator to look at as a predictor of college readiness as well, because typically we use the PSAT to measure, to determine the student's readiness for advanced placement and IB and advanced type courses. So the PSAT may be something to consider in this context, and everybody takes the PSAT.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you. I think those are all really good points. The question about a student moving on to post-secondary education, though, particularly in community college, and I want to clarify, I realize it's a starting point. Nobody's wanting to cut, you know, you always have to start someplace. I'm just starting to hear kids make assessments about whether they should pursue post-secondary education based on whether they have that 2.5. And if we're going to get to that 40-40-20, mm-hmm. we can't only have kids that have a 2.5 or greater thinking that they are ready to go to college, and those below.
Unless we get everybody above a 2.5.
Unless we get everybody above a 2.5. But, I mean, it's not a difficult thing to fall below that 2.5. If you have a bad semester, we're increasing standards. We have some pretty difficult math requirements. I mean, we're wanting kids to do a whole lot of things. And if we're thinking about it in the context of 40-40-20, where post-secondary isn't just about a four-year bachelor's degree, that indicator of college readiness might be very, very
different. So your SAT score or your ACT score, your PSAT score is going to be a predictor of how you're going to do in kind of a rigorous college, academically focused college environment. That isn't necessarily going to show what your readiness is for a career or a certificate program, which is kind of the direction we're going if we're thinking of PK through 14 and having students access that first 2 years of community college that might not be an academic degree at the end. Yeah. So when we're looking at have you mastered the standards, I think that's different than college readiness, or if we need to think of some different words so that there is college degree, 4-year degree readiness, and post-secondary readiness to be ready to pursue a professional degree or a certificate.
Chair Roblin, Senator Geltzer, I don't disagree with you, and I think we think about it very broadly. It's about college and career readiness. So it's a core set of skills that every student needs to be successful, whether they go directly to the workforce or go to a 4-year or 2-year college. And I think there is research, and ACT, I believe, did some studies that showed a direct correlation between this set of skills and college success and work success, and these skills become predictors. And I think that's really what I would encourage our school and districts to focus on is the core set of skills that students need to have in order to be successful. And some of those are academic skills, absolutely, but there are many skills, learning skills. Tony Wagner refers to them as the 7 survival skills. Dave Conley refers to them as learning skills. Some of them are cognitive or non-cognitive skills. Because many students who we think of are as academically prepared, and some of those students have GPAs of 3.5 and above, also require some form of remediation at the post-secondary level, not because they're not academically prepared, but they're not prepared for the rigor and the challenges of the environment. So persistence, perseverance, grit, understanding how to navigate that environment on your own are the things that often cause them to drop out of college. So I think what you're saying, we've got to look at it holistically, and I totally agree. And the counseling component is really important, especially as a bridge between high school and community college and university, which is a new feature of our system. And we're saying this is really important to make sure students are really college and career ready, but we don't abandon them once they leave our system, that we continue to support them. So I appreciate the way you're thinking about it in terms of P20, P14, blurring the lines between grades 11 and through 14, and we're very interested in that. It's just we have to do it in a very methodical and intentional way and expand the options that we're providing students.
And could I just say
one more?
I think what I'm trying to get at, just to clarify one more time, I think as we think about post-secondary education, we need to be careful, because those of us that are in the building, I think, disproportionately come from a worldview that looks at post-secondary education in a very specific way that may not be reflected by large segments of our communities. And as we're creating that transition, I think it needs to be a transition that works for a variety of communities and a variety of set expectations about the role of academics and the role of post-secondary education and what constitutes success. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make sure we're not creating something that's kind of very, very focused on a traditional middle-class American view of post-secondary education.
Yeah, no, I concur. Absolutely.
Any other questions? Thank you. We will probably be seeing more of you during the session, and we appreciate your willingness to come and start giving us a little bit better understanding of what the federal government has done and how we intend to meet the expectations of this new law. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yep. That's pretty much it. So we'll close the informational hearing on the Department of Education and the update on the ESSA, and we will... Any good of the order kinds of things from anybody? If not, our meeting is adjourned. Anybody? If not, our meeting is adjourned. Things from anybody?